Chapter 2. The lobby of the Hotel Grand Leopold II was crowded. There were gendarmes carrying their weapons ostentatiously, talking loudly, lolling against walls and over the bar, women with them, varying in colour from black through to pastel brown, some already drunk, a few Belgians still with the stunned, disbelieving eyes of the refugee, one of the women crying as she rocked her child on her lap. Other white men in civilian clothes, but with the alertness about them and the quick, restless eyes of the adventurer, talking quietly with Africans in business suits. A group of journalists at one table in damp shirt sleeves, waiting and watching with the patience of vultures, and everybody sweated in the heat. Two South African charter pilots hailed Bruce from across the room. "Hi, Bruce. How about a snort?" "Dave, Carl," Bruce waved. "Big hurry now, tonight, perhaps." "We're flying out this afternoon," Carl Engelbrecht shook his head. "Back next week." "We'll make it then," Bruce agreed, and went out of the front door into the Avenue du Casai. As he stopped on the sidewalk, the whitewashed buildings bounced the glare into his face. The naked heat made him wince, and he felt fresh sweat start out of his body beneath his battle suit. He took the dark glasses from his top pocket and put them on as he crossed the street to the Chev three-tonner in which Mike Haig waited. "I'll drive, Mike." "Okay." Mike slid across the seat and Bruce stepped up into the cab. He started the truck north down the Avenue de Casai. "Sorry about that scene, Bruce." "No harm done. I shouldn't have lost my temper like that." Bruce did not answer. He was looking at the deserted buildings on either side. Most of them had been looted, and all of them were pockmarked with shrapnel from the mortar bursts. At intervals along the sidewalk were parked the burnt-out bodies of automobiles, looking like the carapaces of long-dead beetles. "I shouldn't have let him get through to me, and yet the truth hurts like hell." Bruce was silent, but he trod down harder on the accelerator and the truck picked up speed. "I don't want to hear," he thought. "I am not your confessor. I just don't want to hear." He turned into the Avenue L'Etoile, headed towards the zoo. "He was right. He had me measured to the inch," persisted Mike. "We've all got troubles, otherwise we wouldn't be here." And then, to change Mike's mood, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers." Mike grinned, and his face was suddenly boyish. "At least we have the distinction of following the second oldest profession, we, the mercenaries." "The oldest profession is better paid and much more fun," said Bruce, and swung the truck into the driveway of a double-storied residence, parked outside the front door, and switched off the engine. Not long ago, the house had been the home of the chief accountant of Union Minière du Haut. Now it was the billet of D section, special striker force, commanded by Captain Bruce Curry. Half a dozen of his black gendarmes were sitting on the low wall of the veranda, and as Bruce came up the front steps, they shouted the greeting that had become traditional since the United Nations intervention. "UN? Merde." Ah, Bruce grinned at them in the sense of companionship that had grown up between them in the past months. The cream of the army of Katanga. He offered his cigarettes around and stood chatting idly for a few minutes before asking, "Where's Sergeant Major?" One of the gendarmes jerked a thumb at the glass doors that led into the lounge, and Bruce went through with Mike behind him. Equipment was piled haphazardly on the expensive furniture. The stone fireplace was half-filled with empty bottles. A gendarme lay snoring on the Persian carpet. One of the oil paintings on the wall had been ripped by a bayonet, and the frame hung askew. The Mbuya wood coffee table tilted drunkenly towards its broken leg, and the whole lounge smelled of men and cheap tobacco. "Hello, Ruffy," said Bruce. "Just in time, boss." Sergeant Major Raffararo grinned delightedly from the armchair which he was overflowing. "These goddamn Arabs have run fresh out of the folding stuff." He gestured at the gendarmes that crowded around the table in front of him. Arab was Ruffy's word of censure or contempt, and bore no relation to a man's nationality. Ruffy's accent was always a shock to Bruce. You never expected to hear pure Americanese come rumbling out of that huge black frame. But 3 years previously, Ruffy had returned from a scholarship tour of the United States with a command of the idiom, a diploma in land husbandry, a prodigious thirst for bottled beer, preferably Schlitz, but any other was acceptable, and a raving dose of the old Joe. The memory of this last, which had been a farewell gift from a high yellow sophomore of UCLA, returned most painfully to Raffarero when he was in his cups, so painfully that it could be assuaged only by throwing the nearest citizen of the United States. Fortunately, it was only on rare occasions that an American and the necessary 5 or 6 gallons of beer were assembled in the same vicinity, so that Ruffy's latent race antipathy could find expression. A throwing by Ruffy was an unforgettable experience, both for the victim and the spectators. Bruce vividly recalled that night at the Hotel Lido, when he had been a witness at one of Ruffy's most spectacular throwings. The victims, 3 of them, were journalists representing publications of repute. As the evening wore on, they talked louder. An American accent has a carry like a well-hit golf ball, and Ruffy recognized it from across the terrace. He became silent, and in his silence drank the last gallon, which was necessary to tip the balance. He wiped the froth from his upper lip and stood up with his eyes fastened on the party of Americans. "Ruffy, hold it, hey!" Bruce might not have spoken. Ruffy started across the terrace. They saw him coming and fell into an uneasy silence. The first was in the nature of a practice throw. Besides, the man was not aerodynamically constructed, and his stomach had too much wind resistance, a middling distance of 20 feet. "Ruffy, leave them!" shouted Bruce. On the next throw, Ruffy was getting warmed up, but he put excessive loft into it, 30 feet. The journalist cleared the terrace and landed on the lawn below with his empty glass still clutched in his hand. "Run, you fool!" Bruce warned the third victim, but he was paralysed. And this was Ruffy's best ever. He took a good grip, neck and seat of the pants, and put his whole weight into it. Ruffy must have known that he had executed the perfect throw, for his shout of "Gonorrhea!" as he launched his man, had a ring of triumph to it. Afterwards, when Bruce had soothed the 3 Americans, and they had recovered sufficiently to appreciate the fact that they were privileged by being party to a record-throwing session, they all paced out the distances. The 3 journalists developed an almost proprietary affection for Ruffy, and spent the rest of the evening buying him beers and boasting to every newcomer in the bar. One of them, he who had been thrown last and farthest, wanted to do an article on Ruffy with pictures. Towards the end of the evening, he was talking wildly of whipping up sufficient international enthusiasm to have a man-throwing event included in the Olympic Games. Ruffy accepted both their praise and their beer with modest gratitude, and when the 3rd American offered to let Ruffy throw him again, he declined the offer on the grounds that he never threw the same man twice. All in all, it had been a memorable evening. Apart from these occasional lapses, Ruffy had a more powerful body and happier mind than any man Bruce had ever known, and Bruce could not help liking him. He could not prevent himself smiling as he tried to reject Ruffy's invitation to play cards. "We've got work to do now, Ruffy, some other time." "Sit down, boss. We'll play just a couple of tricks, then we talk about work." He shuffled the 3 cards back and forth between his hands. "Sit down, boss," Ruffy repeated, and Bruce grimaced resignedly and took the chair opposite him. "How much you going to bet?" Ruffy leaned forward. "1,000,000. Bruce laid a 1,000-franc note on the table. "When that's gone, then we go." "No hurry," Ruffy soothed him. "We got all day." He dealt the 3 cards face down. "The old Christian monarch's in there somewhere. All you gotta do is find him, and it's the easiest meal you ever made." "In the middle," whispered the gendarme standing beside Bruce's chair. "That's him in the middle." "Take no notice of that mad Arab. He's lost 5,000,000 already this morning," Ruffy advised. Bruce turned over the right-hand card. "Miss Luck," crowed Ruffy. "You got yourself the Queen of Hearts." He picked up the banknote and stuffed it into his breast pocket. She'll see you wrong every time, that sweet-faced little bitch. Grinning, he turned over the middle card to expose the Jack of Spades with his sly eyes and curly little moustache. She's been shacked up there with a jack right under the old king's nose. He turned the king face up. Look you at that dozy old guy. He's not even facing in the right direction. Bruce stared at the three cards, and he felt that sickness in his stomach again. The whole story was there. Even the man's name was right. But the Jack should have worn a beard and driven a red Jaguar, and his Queen of Hearts never had such innocent eyes. Bruce spoke abruptly. That's it, Ruffy. I want you and 10 men to come with me. Where are we going? Down to Ordnance. We're drawing special supplies. Ruffy nodded and buttoned the playing cards into his top pocket while he selected the gendarmes to accompany them. Then he asked Bruce, We might need some oil. What do you think, boss? Bruce hesitated. They had only 2 cases of whiskey left of the dozen they had looted in August. The purchasing power of a bottle of genuine scotch was enormous, and Bruce was loath to use them except in extraordinary circumstances. But now he realized that his chances of getting the supplies he needed were remote, unless he took along a substantial bribe for the quartermaster. Okay, Ruffy, bring a case. Ruffy came up out of the chair and clapped his steel helmet on his head. The chin straps hung down on each side of his round, black face. A full case? He grinned at Bruce. You want to buy a battleship? Almost, agreed Bruce. Go and get it. Ruffy disappeared into the back area of the house and returned almost immediately with a case of Grant's Standfast under one arm and 6 bottles of Simba beer held by their necks between the fingers of his other hand. We might get thirsty, he explained. The gendarmes climbed into the back of the truck with a clatter of weapons and shouted cheerful abuse at their fellows on the veranda. Bruce, Mike, and Ruffy crowded into the cab, and Ruffy set the whiskey on the floor and placed 2 large booted feet upon it. What's this all about, boss? He asked as Bruce trundled the truck down the drive and turned into the Avenue L'Etoile. Bruce told him, and when he had finished, Ruffy grunted noncommittally and opened a bottle of beer with his big white chisel-blade teeth. The gas hissed softly, and a little froth ran down the bottle and dripped onto his lap. My boys aren't going to like that, he commented as he offered the open bottle to Mike Haig. Mike shook his head, and Ruffy passed the bottle to Bruce. Ruffy opened a bottle for himself and spoke again. They're going to hate it like hell, he shook his head. And there'll be even bigger trouble when we get to Port Reprieve and pick up the diamonds. Bruce glanced sideways at him, startled. What diamonds? From the dredgers, said Ruffy. You don't think they're sending us all that way just to bring in these other guys? They're worried about the diamonds, that's for sure. Suddenly, for Bruce, much which had puzzled him was explained. A half-forgotten conversation that he had held earlier in the year with an engineer from Union Minière jumped back into his memory. They had discussed the 3 diamond dredgers that worked the gravel from the bed of the Lufira swamps. The boats were based on Fort Reprieve, and clearly they would have returned there at the beginning of the emergency. They must still be there, with 3 or 4 months' recovery of diamonds on board, something like 500,000 sterling in uncut stones. That was the reason why the Katangese government placed such priority on this expedition, the reason why such a powerful force was being used, the reason why no approaches had been made to the UN authorities to conduct the rescue. Bruce smiled sardonically as he remembered the humanitarian arguments that had been given to him by the Minister of the Interior. It is our duty, Captain Curry. We cannot leave these people to the not-so-tender mercy of the tribesmen. It is our duty as civilized human beings. There were others cut off in remote mission stations and government outposts throughout southern Kasai and Katanga. Nothing had been heard of them for months, but their welfare was secondary to that of the settlement at Port Reprieve. Bruce lifted the bottle to his lips again, steering with one hand and squinting ahead through the windscreen as he drank. All right, We'll fetch them in, and afterwards an ammunition box will be loaded onto a chartered aircraft, and later still there'll be another deposit to a numbered account in Zurich. Why should I worry? They're paying me for it. I don't think we should mention the diamonds to my boys, Ruffy spoke sadly. I don't think that would be a good idea at all. Bruce slowed the truck as they ran into the industrial area beyond the railway line. He watched the buildings as they passed, until he recognized the one he wanted and swung off the road to stop in front of the gate. He blew a blast on the hooter, and a gendarme came out and inspected his pass minutely. Satisfied, he shouted out to someone beyond the gate, and it swung open. Bruce drove the truck through into the yard and switched off the engine. There were half a dozen other trucks parked in the yard, all emblazoned with a Katangi's shield and surrounded by gendarmes in uniforms patchy with sweat. A white lieutenant leaned from the cab of one of the trucks and shouted, "Ciao, Bruce!" "How things, Sergio?" Bruce answered him. "Crazy, crazy." Bruce smiled. For the Italian, everything was crazy. Bruce remembered that in July, during the fighting at the road bridge, he had bent him over the bonnet of a Land Rover and, with a bayonet, dug a piece of shrapnel out of his hairy buttocks. That also had been crazy. "See you around." Bruce dismissed him and led Mike and Ruffy across the yard to the warehouse. There was a sign on the large double doors, "Depot Ordinance, Armée du Katanga," and beyond them, at a desk in a glass cubicle, sat a major with a pair of Gandhi-type steel-rimmed spectacles perched on a face like that of a jovial black toad. He looked up at Bruce. "Non," he said with finality. "Non, non." Bruce produced his requisition form and laid it before him. The major brushed it aside contemptuously. "We have not got these items. We are destitute. I cannot do it. No, I cannot do it. There are priorities. There are circumstances to consider. No, I am sorry." He snatched a sheaf of papers from the side of his desk and turned his whole attention to them, ignoring Bruce. "This requisition is signed by Monsieur le Président," Bruce pointed out mildly, and the major laid down his papers and came round from behind the desk. He stood close to Bruce with the top of his head on a level with Bruce's chin. "Had it been signed by the Almighty himself, it would be of no use. I am sorry. I am truly sorry." Bruce lifted his eyes and for a second allowed them to wander over the mountains of stores which packed the interior of the warehouse. From where he stood, he could identify at least 20 items that he needed. The major noticed the gesture, and his French became so excited that Bruce could make out only the repeated use of the word "non." He glanced significantly at Ruffy, and the sergeant major stepped forward and placed an arm soothingly about the major's shoulders. Then, very gently, he led him, still protesting, out into the yard and across to the truck. He opened the door of the cab, and the major saw the case of whiskey. A few minutes later, after Ruffy had prized open the lid with his bayonet and allowed the major to inspect the seals on the caps, they returned to the office with Ruffy carrying the case. "Captain," said the major as he picked up the requisition form from the desk, "I see now that I was mistaken. This is indeed signed by Monsieur le Président. It is my duty to afford you the most urgent priority." Bruce murmured his thanks, and the major beamed at him. "I will give you men to help you." "You are too kind. It would disrupt your routine. I have my own men." "Excellent," agreed the major, and waved a podgy hand around the warehouse. "Take what you need."